Good morning. It is Friday at the State Capitol. We are in Senate Finance. The time is 9:09. We are here today to look at a fiscal analysis of the Heads of Agreement and Memorandum of Understanding with Black & Veatch Management Consultants. With me at the table this morning, Senator Meyer, Senator Dunleavy, and myself, Senator Fairclough. Joining us is Senator Olson, and soon to follow will be the rest of the committee. Before us today, you have a slide presentation, TransCanada participation in AK LNG project, presentation to the Senate Finance Committee, prepared for the state of Alaska. Deepa, if you would identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Good morning. For the record, my name is Deepa Porthal. I am a principal with Black & Veatch. We have been supporting the state administration with economic analysis and commercial support on the Alaska LNG project. I neglected to mention this when I was in front of this committee on Wednesday, but Senator Dunleavy reminded me that I should today, that I have worked with the state on gas monetization efforts for the last 7 or 8 years now. Started toward the end of SGDA, supported through the AGIA process, and for the last 2 years here, about 2 years here on the Alaska LNG project. My colleague Jason Gestichter is on the line as well. He has supported much of the analysis here, and he's available to answer questions as needed.
Thank you, Ms. Puddevall. Just Jason has not joined us yet, but we'll keep looking for him.
Okay, thanks. Fine.
If I might, for the record, Senator Bishop has joined us. With that, if we could proceed with the presentation, Ms. Puddevall.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Ms. Puddevall.
Thank you. On Wednesday, when I was here in front of this committee, we walked through one of the two major agreements that is in front of you this session, and that was the heads of agreement between the producers, TransCanada, the state administration, as well as AGDC. Today I'm going to focus on the other one, which is the memorandum of understanding between the state and the state administration and TransCanada. I want to highlight, you know, what some of the key elements are of that agreement and walk through, you know, our assessment of what value TransCanada brings to this, brings to the table within the context of the Alaska LNG project. On slide 3 here, I'm just listing what some of the highlights are. The first is that TransCanada will hold the state's equity share in the GTP and pipeline elements of the Alaska LNG project. The state, through the AGDC subsidiary as it's envisioned now, will continue to hold its equity share in the LNG plant itself. The state will have the option to buy back 40% of the share that TC would hold at the start of the FEED stage, which is the front-end engineering and design stage, expected to start in 2016. The state will commit to a 25-year transportation agreement with TransCanada for services through the GTP as well as pipeline for the share that TransCanada will hold. This agreement commits TransCanada to a weighted average cost of capital of 6.75%. And I'll walk through that more as we get into the meat of the presentation. And there are various milestones and off-ramps that are defined within the agreement for both the state as well as TransCanada. So just to give us a visual orientation of what the options are with TransCanada participating in the project, on slide 4 here, the first is fairly straightforward. It's the option where the state goes alone in holding its share of the equity in the AKLNG project. And so assuming a 25% stake for the state, what that means is the state would hold 25% of the GTP, the pipeline, as well as the LNG plant. Next is an option where the state brings in TransCanada but does not exercise a buyback. And what that would result in is that that TC would hold 25% of the GTP as well as pipeline in the project, and the state would hold 25% in the LNG plant. Then you get to the last option here, which is the state with TransCanada but with a buyback option. What happens in this option is that at the beginning of pre-FEED, which is envisioned today, the state would assign 25% of the GTP and pipeline share to TransCanada. And then once pre-FEED is completed, the state has the option of buying back 10% of that share. And so that would result in TC holding 15% through the GTP and pipeline, and the state holding 10% in the GTP and pipeline. And the state's share, the 25% share in the LNG plant, would remain unchanged through all three options.
Senator Dunleavy.
Excuse me, through the chair. The state, what is the entity within the state that will hold this share? Is it...
As it's envisioned now, it would be the AGDC subsidiary that would hold the share.
Thank you.
Dunleavy?
Thank you.
Ms. Puttival, I just wanted to let you know that Jason is online as well as Matt Fisher from Houston and Black and Veatch.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
On slide five, starting to put some numbers to the simple concept we saw on the previous slide and looking at these three different options. What we have at the very top of the slide are the different stages of the project's development between now and when it becomes operational. And so the first 2 years, both the latter half of 2014 as well as next year would be the pre-FEED, and then the subsequent 3 years, 2016 through 18, is the FEED stage, and then 2019 through 2023, which is a five-year period, would be construction. And there's an important step there between 2018 and 2019, which is the final investment decision, and that's where the real dollars get committed to the project. If you recall my testimony from Wednesday, that's about 95% of the project's costs start getting spent that point forward. The three alternative options that we looked at on the previous slide, with the state going it alone and assuming a 25% state equity participation, you can see the cash, the investment that the state would need to make at each of these different stages. The first stage is about $100 million, $110 million if you want to round it up. In FEED, you're getting close to $450 million, and then comes the big money during construction, over $13 billion. And that is the most expensive option for the state of the three on the table here from the perspective of your upfront investment in the project.
Just for clarification, Deepa, Is it cumulative then that you're showing us, or are those individual prices? If I'm looking at the state of Alaska, go it alone, is the 108 a standalone number and then the 450 a standalone number, or is the 108 included in the 450 as it goes out?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. It's a really good one. Each of these numbers are incremental, so they're not cumulative. It's what would be needed for that phase. With the next option, which is bringing TC in but not exercising a buyback, essentially TransCanada would be paying for the GTP and pipeline. And what that does is it reduces the upfront investment that the state is making across all three of those stages, as you can see here. The boxes in red I'm going to come back to, so if you will bear with me, let's just go to the third option and talk through, you know, with the buyback, what the state's investments would be. So the last set of the TC with the 40% buyback option shows that in the first stage, you'll notice, it's the same investment as the case with TC with no buyback. The $43 million for pre-feed does not change because you have not yet exercised your option to buy back the 10% from TC. But starting with the next phase, which is feed, at which point you've exercised the option to buy back 10%, then the state's investment in the feed stage goes up to $360 million, and then in construction up to over $9 billion. What the red boxes show are off-ramps, where if the state chooses to, or TransCanada chooses to, we can take TC out of the picture, to put it simply, by paying them for the development cost that they've invested up to that stage of the project. I want to make one point here about what that payment to TC means. So let's look at the first red box, which is the TC no buyback option, and it sits at the end of pre-feed. It says pay TC development cost of $70 million, and it includes an AFUDC of $5 million. What that means is that we're paying back TC for its expenses during those 2 years of the project, but we're also giving TC an interest on that money for those 2 years. And that is the AFUDC. It's just a rate-making term that means interest costs, the weighted average cost of capital. And what we should notice, so of that $70 million, if we want to break that down, that means $65 million was their investment during those 2 years, and then an additional $5 million was sort of the equivalent of an interest cost that the state pays TC at that off-ramp. And so although we look at that $70 million as being, you know, a lump sum, the way I think about that is $65 million of those dollars would have been what the state would have paid anyway if we had made those investments during pre-feed ourselves. And so the additional cost of having TransCanada make that investment through that stage of the process for us is really the interest payment that we're paying, which is the $5 million here. And that concept carries through, you know, through the other red boxes that are shown here too. If we exercise an off ramp at the end of feed, then we pay TC its development cost of $390 million. And the way to think about that is $340 million of those dollars is what we would have spent without having TC in that picture. And we're giving them $50 million at an interest rate of about 7%. Okay, so that interest is really our cost of having TC front that expense for us through that stage of the process.
Ms. Pudoval? So that's what I was calculating out, was the average rate of interest that we were paying. But could you tell me, and maybe it's a better question for our own Department of Revenue, if that money was sitting in the bank, what's the delta between that? So I believe some of your previous slides have shown us that opportunity cost of the, under one scenario, of the $65 million investment. So we're actually, I'd just like to see those numbers run by the Department of Revenue in the future. So I'm sorry to interrupt your.
Okay. Okay, so slide six. Having laid that background, that, you know, this is the DeLonge table, these are the different structural elements, I want to now step through the part of the presentation where we're looking at four key questions in understanding the value of TransCanada's participation in the project. The first one is there an economic impact to the state from having TC in the picture? The second question we're going to focus on is, can the state go it alone? Is that an attractive option for us? The third question is TC a good partner, assuming we need a partner? And then the fourth question I'm going to walk us through is, does TC bear any financial risk in this deal? What is their exposure if they're in this with us? taking up our first question, what is the economic impact of the state from TransCanada's participation? This is a schematic just to wrap our heads around how these cash flows will work with TC in the picture. The left portion of this graphic, left of that orange line, is the project development and construction time frame. That's the time, that's the entire pre-FEED, FEED, and construction time frame that we saw in the previous slides. During that period of time, what the deal allows is for TC to pay between 60 and 100% of the state's upfront capital costs for the GTP and pipeline. They pay 100% if we don't exercise the buyback. They pay 60% if we do exercise the buyback and take on 10% of the share. In exchange for that, over 25 years of the project's initial operation, the state will pay TC a negotiated tariff for that same 60 to 100% of the GTP and pipeline's capacity that is used to move the state's gas. Okay? And so what the economic analysis is going to look at is what is the net impact of having these reduced upfront payments and then having these payment obligations through tariffs to TC over the first 25 years of the project's operations. And if we put numbers to that, slide 8 lays out what that picture looks like with the three different options in front of us. The blue line, the light blue line, is the option where the state goes alone. The gray line is where the state involves TC in the transaction, but buys back a portion of the GTP and pipeline. And then the green line is where the state brings TC to participate in the project, but does not buy back a portion of the GTP and pipeline. And so this starts becoming fairly obvious. But the more you spend, in other words, the more the dip is in the initial years, the more your cash flows are in your out years. And TransCanada's participation up front reduces the state's cash costs by between $1.5 and $2 billion, assuming the state uses a 70-30 debt equity to finance the project. And then the impact on the back end is that having TC in the picture reduces the annual revenues to the state by between $200 and $360 million, depending on which of those lines we choose with TC. If you add it all up, we show what happens when you go to slide 9. The green bars on the left take the cumulative cash flows over that entire time period that I showed you, starting from development, going all the way through when our agreement with TransCanada would end 25 years into the project's operation. And what that would show is, on an undiscounted basis, TransCanada's participation does come at a certain cost to the state. It's about 4% or so, where if you assume that the state involves TransCanada in the picture and exercises a 40% buyback, as it's expected the state might do, then that has a cost of about $4 billion over that entire time period to the state. If you look at it on a discounted basis, which is the NPV, the blue bars on the right show that it's kind of a wash. You know, there's a small erosion of value when you go from the go-it-alone option to the options with TransCanada in the picture, but when it's rounded up to the nearest $1 billion in the context of this project, they're about equivalent. And where that really, and why that shakes out that way is because the upfront investment by the state is so impactful on the NPV, right? When you're looking at money today is worth a lot more than money is worth 20 years from now. And so being able to reduce what the state spends over the initial part of the project's development and construction before there are any revenues available to offset those cash costs that the state has value. And And I put that little red sentence there just to give us context. Through this 25-year period, TransCanada's NPV, just to put, you know, put that in the scale, is somewhere between $150 and $200 million, if you want to compare that to the $13 billion that you know, the state achieves from the project. So moving on to the next question, can the state go it alone? We're going to look at it from two different perspectives. The first perspective is, what are the capital cost and investment implications of going it alone? How much money is the state going to need to have available to meet the requirements of this project? And then the second perspective is, what are the debt implications of going it alone? In other words, you know, it's a reasonable question to ask, can't we just issue debt to finance this project? And so just trying to understand some boundaries around that. I shared the next two slides with you on Wednesday, but I think it's relevant here, and so I'm bringing it back into the discussion. And what this is highlighting is that having TransCanada in the picture allows the state to reduce its upfront investment in the project. And that is the period of highest exposure for the state because the revenues from the project haven't yet started hitting the state's coffers. And so any cash outlays that the state is making is not offset by those revenues. And so especially in a project as big as this, and if it has cost overruns, the amount that the state has committed to invest in this project could change, and the state would be exposed to having that additional investment available, you know, if the project's cost estimates change as you go through the development process. And having TransCanada in the picture essentially allows the state to retain the 20-25% equity share that's being talked about here, while only being responsible for 13-18% of the upfront costs. And you see the math on that on slide 12. The blue lines essentially represent what the state's investment would need to be going it alone. On the left, we're looking at a reference case capital cost estimate of $45 billion. On the right, we look at a case with cost overruns that takes you to $54 billion. And that's, you know, that's the high range of what the producers have said the project's cost could be. And what you see here is that having TransCanada in the picture reduces the state's investment obligation by $4 billion, by about $4 billion under the base capital cost estimate, and reduces it by $5 billion if there's a cost overrun. And so it has a very meaningful and significant impact on how much the state will be required to put up before this project is operational.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Through the Chair. Just for folks listening, when you look at page 12, and we keep hearing, and then we see on the bottom, assume state exercises 30-40% equity buyback from TransCanada. Can you once again just explain for folks that haven't been following this what that means?
Sure, I would be happy to. Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I'm going to take us back to this visual on slide 4 because I think it helps to explain best what that buyback means. Every time in this presentation where we say there is no buyback, we're talking about that middle case here where TC holds 25% of the GTP and pipeline and continues to hold that 25% for the life of the project. And when we talk about with the buyback option, what we are referring to is the bottom case where initially, TC is given 25% of the GTP and pipeline, but when you get to the second stage of the project development, which is FEED, the state has the option of buying some of that back from TC. And so 40% of 25% is the 10% that's shown here. And so the state would then end up holding 10% of the GTP and pipeline and TC will be left with 15% of the GDP in pipeline.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 13, you know, on 12, we looked at the aggregate investment that the state would have to make and saw the impact on that. On 13, we're looking at the annual investment requirement that the state would have to support its equity share in the project. And the years that really catch your attention would be at the peak of construction, which is 2020 and 2021, when the investment that's needed for the project are at their highest. And what we're showing here are the three different paths of what those annual investments would need to be if the state went alone, if the state brought TC in without the buyback and with the buyback. And what this demonstrates basically is during those years of peak investment and peak construction, having TransCanada in the picture can reduce the state's investment by between $1.5 and $2 billion. So just a different lens to look at, you know, how TC can change the investment obligation that the state would have up front.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And this, Deepa, this would is, and this is, when you charted this page here, mm-hmm. is that within the range of 45 to 54?
This is just, Senator Bishop through the chair, this is just looking at the $45 billion baseline costs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop.
Part two of the question, can the state go it alone? I said we would look at it from a debt perspective, and that's what we're going to do in the next two slides. I will preface this by saying these two are probably the most complex concept in today's discussion, and so we can take some time going through it. But what we're trying to get to is to wrap our arms around the concept of why can't the state just debt finance the whole thing? Why can't we issue debt to support the investment that's needed from the state in the Alaska LNG project? That is certainly an option. And I want to highlight, just to put some bounds around that, that there are some issues that come into play when we start thinking about that. The first is, at what cost would the state be able to finance this? And you want to compare that to the 6.75 line in the sand that the TC transaction gives us. And then the second part of that is how much of Alaska's general fund unrestricted revenue do you want to allocate to be able to service the debt associated with the AKLNG project? And that's recognizing that the state has, you know, several other obligations to meet as well, building schools and roads and other things, and quite frankly, even the supporting infrastructure that would go with this project. And you want to start thinking about how much of you know, the unrestricted revenues from the general fund would go just to support the debt associated with this project if the state chose to finance it completely with debt. There's three scenarios that are laid out here, and they're nothing but just indicative assumptions based on input from the Department of Revenue, okay? The first scenario, put very simply, is sort of your high-quality debt. It has your lowest interest, and then the last scenario is the one that would be thought of as lower quality, or the lowest quality of the three scenarios we're looking at here, debt that comes at a higher cost. And scenario two is just in between those two cases. The cost of debt that's been assumed for each of these scenarios ties into the market as it is today. And so the lower cost debt issuing appropriations-based debt is 4.6%. And then when you get to the next scenario, you're at close to 5%. And then you get to the next scenario, you're up to 5.6%. Okay? tying in the concept of what is the debt service and how much of the general fund unrestricted revenue you want to dedicate to that debt, that is related to the quality of debt that you can get. Okay? If you are someone that's lending to Alaska for this project, the lower the portion of the general fund unrestricted revenue that is needed to pay me back, the more comfort I have in issuing that debt to the state. And so that's the relationship you see here between the percentage of general fund unrestricted revenue that would need to be dedicated to service the debt and the interest rate. And so the first scenario where only 3% of the general fund unrestricted revenue would be needed to service my debt is the one where I lend you money at the cheapest interest rate. And then the higher the percentage of your general fund unrestricted revenue that is needed to service my debt, the more I'm going to charge you in interest to lend you that money. One other watermark that I want to define here is that as general good debt policy, and I'm speaking here based on information that the Treasury has given me, is that the state tries to stay under 8% of the general fund unrestricted revenue for its entire debt servicing. And so you want to think about, if you're in scenario 3 and you've taken on debt which would need up to 6% of your general fund unrestricted revenue just to pay back the debt associated with the Alaska LNG project, that only leaves the state with about 2% of general fund unrestricted revenue to service all other debt that the state might need and still maintain a prudent debt policy.
Senator Dunleavy.
Excuse me. The 8% quote policy that the state of Alaska has put forward, how does that compare with other states in terms of what they do? Just curiosity.
Senator Dunleavy, I am not qualified to give you information on that. I would defer to Treasury on that. I will say, though, that for the last few years, the state is well below that 8% limit. I believe, it's closer to 4 or 5% right now for the state.
If I could put on the record, then we'd like for the committee answers to that question. We'd like to know how formal the policy is within the state. Is that established in statute, or is that a regulation that the state has adopted? And is it a best practice, and could you give us some comparisons to how other states or large entities operate on their debt service? So a nice example would be if we knew what Exxon did for debt, or ConocoPhillips, other business entities that are in the resource business are somewhat similar to what we're managing, to a single source of revenue inside of the energy sector, but also what other states do as far as best practices in government. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
If I could just follow up on that, if we could get our current debt ratio as well. I think you said about 4 or 5 is...
Between 4 and 5.
That's our current with the state of Alaska?
That's my understanding, but that's something that Treasury should probably confirm for you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Meyer, thank you for that follow-up. In addition to that, over the 10 to 25 year time period, then it would be important to know what our debt is projected out in cash flow to look like. We have seen some scenarios at this table that show our debt, three different entities from the state of Alaska's budget, debt, K through 12 education, and health and human services would be 100% of our budget in 10 years. So besides just knowing what it is today, it would be good for the finance committee specifically to understand what that debt ratio looks like as we progress forward with different cash calls.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So having laid out those assumptions and, the foundational facts on how issuing debt by the state would work, let's look at what that means in the context of the Alaska LNG project. And that's what we're doing here on slide 15. So what slide 15 is looking at is assuming you have those three scenarios, those three options of sourcing debt for this project, coming with their associated interest expense, and the debt service obligations that come with those, how much debt can the state borrow without violating that debt service limit constraint? The WARs are organized, so the first three are looking at the option where the state's going it alone, and the state's total investment obligation there are a little over $11.5 billion. Okay, and then the middle three set of bars is the state with TransCanada and exercising the buyback option, and there you're close to about $7 billion. That's the state's total investment need. And then you move to the three bars on the very right. That's the option where the state brings in TransCanada and does not exercise the buyback option, and you're a little under $6 billion in what the state's total investment need is. The green portion of each of these bars is showing how much debt the state can borrow. And so when you look at the go-it-alone option and say, well, why can't the state do this without TransCanada, without a partner? What starts becoming apparent here is that we're restricted by how much can be borrowed to finance this project. Even at, as you're climbing that interest rate curve and you're getting to more and more expensive debt, even with today's financial markets, even if you're borrowing at 5.6% interest rate, you're only able to borrow about 50% of the investment that's needed for this project and not violate your debt service as a percentage of your general fund unrestricted revenue. When you move to the options with TransCanada, you start seeing that with the more expensive debt, especially the ones that's close to 5% and then the 5.6%, you're able to leverage, a significant portion of what the state would need. You're able to finance anywhere from 60 to 90% of that. And that starts appearing more reasonable in terms of the debt capacity that the state can take on. And again, the concept to be mindful of here is, even if standalone the Alaska LNG project can be financed, we have to think about how much debt capacity does that leave for the state to borrow for all of its other activities that it needs to do. Okay.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, it might be interesting. This is probably more for DOA or
DOR.
DOR. I'm sorry.
Department of Revenue.
Yes, thank you. A model, I've lost my thought on the DOA there. A model, and let me come back to this. Let me come back
to this. Senator Dunleavy. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Can you give us a comparison, if you could, on how Table 5 and Table 15 relate with the total construction costs? How are they related, like in the $9.3 billion with the TC 40% buyback, and how that relates to the same category on 15, the $9.3 billion.
Okay. Senator Hoffman, through the chair, thank you for that question. It's a really good one. There are a couple of moving parts between, slide 5 and slide 15. What slide five is showing is the breakup over each stage of the project, and slide 15 is a total of all of those put together. Okay. And then the second moving part is that on slide 15, we're looking at the state investing a 20% equity in the project. And thank you for your question, because I should have pointed that out earlier. Whereas on slide 5, we're looking at the state investing 25% in the project. And I'll explain why we picked 20% to show on 15. The thought there was, let's see if this can be done at 20% first. And if it can, then we move up and say, well, can we now do 25%? If we had looked at 25% first and the answer was it can't be done, then it raises the question, well, can you do 20%? And so as a conservative estimate, we decided, let's look at the smallest investment that the state would make in this project and see if that's doable, and maybe that answers the question.
Senator Hoffman, follow-up?
No, that's it. Thanks.
Senator Bishop?
No, I'll hold it.
Senator Dunleavy?
I'll wait, thank you.
Please proceed. Is this a good stopping point? Are we done with discussions on slide 15? The bells, I'm not sure that those at home can hear, but those at home are, we're being called to the Senate floor. So is this a good point to stop and then retake this up at 5 o'clock this afternoon? Are you still available?
I am on a flight at 2 o'clock this afternoon, unfortunately.
Brief at ease?
Yeah, brief at ease.
We're back on the record, just trying to get travel details outlined. With that, are there any further questions or comments on slide 15? Seeing and hearing none, I just want those at home that are following this particular presentation that is beginning on February 24th, 2014. That conversation will continue starting with slide 16 on Monday, this next Monday. So with that, any comments from committee members? Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, we will continue the discussion on this tonight at 5 o'clock. I believe we have our consultants, Janet Kanikos, will be presenting on a different topic, but still on gas. And then we'll continue with this topic on Monday, I believe Monday at 9.
One option.
Monday at 9 a.m.
Yep.
With that, thank you, Senator.
And if I may, we will be meeting Monday at 8 o'clock. And actually, we're going to do finance bills starting Monday at 8 and go through the normal time, 11, and then Monday evening we'll take up this topic again. My apologies.
Mr. Pulaski, would you join us at the mics and identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Pulaski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. We are also going to try and see if we can arrange Ms. Podoval on a later flight tonight. I just talked to her about that. If it's possible, we can defer to Monday, but we also can and work to try and make it tonight.
So for those of you following at home and at the table here today, we'll slip into neutral and say that we are making every attempt to make sure that we can finish the presentation tonight. But stay tuned. Watch the Senate Finance website, and we'll be updating you. But we are meeting this evening. That is the for sure thing, and what's before us may be a continuation of today's presentation, will be a presentation from Analytica. So, with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to call the Senate Finance back to order. I think we left off this morning, Ms. Puddevall, is that correct? Puddevall, okay, was presenting, and I believe you had a few more slides to go through, and then we'll go to our next presenters. We will have to conclude, though, by 6:30, so hopefully we'll be finished by then. So the floor is yours, Ms. Puddevall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Deepa Puddevall. I'm principal with Black & Veatch. My colleague, Jason DeStichter, is on the phone and available for questions as needed. We're picking up here from this morning, starting on slide 16. I know it's been a long day, so just to refresh our memory on the discussion we were having, we were trying to understand what value TransCanada brings to the AKLNG project, and we were going through that exercise by asking four different questions. Now I will stop here just to refresh our memory on what they were. The first was, what is the economic impact of the state from having TransCanada participate in the Alaska LNG project? The second was, can the state go it alone? The third was, is TransCanada a good partner? And the fourth is, does TransCanada bear any financial risk in this transaction? So we covered the first two questions this morning, and I'm going to pick up from the third, asking, is TransCanada a good partner for the state?
Okay, Ms. Puddevall, before you proceed, I'm delinquent in not introducing the committee members. We have Senator Olson, sure. Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Senator Fairclough. And I appreciate you changing your flight schedules to be with us tonight.
So. I'm happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Okay. Continue, please.
Asking the question whether TC is a good partner for the state, I want to point to the green box here and make the distinction that we're not evaluating different financing options for this pipeline. In other words, TC is not acting just as a bank in this transaction to reduce the state's upfront capital costs in exchange for annualized payments from us over a period of time. What TransCanada is a very experienced pipeline builder, owner, and operator. And they're particularly qualified to do business here in Alaska because their experience includes a high level of experience with Northern Pipelines. And so, although the Alaska project itself will be, you know, very challenging given the environmental conditions here and the location, TransCanada is probably one of the companies that will bring its Northern Pipeline experience to benefit the project. The next fact about TransCanada that should be material to Alaskans is that TransCanada has a long history of interest in developing an Alaska pipeline. Through the years, they have been involved here in one way or the other, and the last attempt at that was being the AGL licensee, where they were the only company to submit a complete application in that process, indicating their seriousness as well as interest in participating in an Alaska project. The third fact that I'm highlighting here is that having TransCanada as an independent third party as part of this project helps facilitate expansion as well as access. Let me stop to explain my rationale there. We talked earlier about, you know, creating alignment in the project and what the different incentives of the different parties could be. As a pipeline company, your incentive is to expand the pipeline and transport more volumes because it increases the volume of your business, and that's how your revenues grow. And so coming in as a third-party pipeline owner and operator into this project, TransCanada inherently has incentive to facilitate any expansion that it can. If you put on your producer hat and think about that, and you're building a project, your interests lie in maximizing your revenues and allowing other producers into your project through a future expansion doesn't necessarily line up with that incentive. And so there is value from the perspective of having access and opening the North Slope up for more exploration and development activity to having a neutral third party in the mix. And the fourth point here is that having TransCanada participate in the project can help to retain the momentum of the project. And where that comes from is that one, TransCanada has been here, has been involved as part of AGEA in studying the pipeline route, and there's a body of work and experience that comes with that will need to be replicated by whoever will take their place. And two, relationships exist right now because of the discussions that have supported the HOA and an MOU between the producers and TransCanada. And again, that's one of those things that it's hard to put, concrete timelines to, but to recreate those relationships with a new party, it just takes time for things to settle in. So not to say that, it's a certainty that the state will lose time or the project will lose time without TransCanada in the picture, but there's a likelihood, and it's more than a low probability event. One more point about momentum in the project and staying with the project's timeline is, if we want to bring some other party into this project, we'd like, and there's questions being asked about why haven't we tried to solicit bids and seen, whether the deal we have is the best deal we could possibly get. We can certainly go through that process, but that's going to take time, just as we saw, the time that it took to pull AGEA together and to award a license. And if you look at the terms that we would be trying to improve upon, the two main ones would be, what is the debt equity structure that's been offered by TransCanada, and what is the return they're expecting on their equity? The combination of those, as well as the cost of debt that they have offered as part of the transportation agreement for the state, creates your weighted average cost of capital. And that was that 6.75% number that I mentioned earlier. And so what TransCanada has put on the table is a 75% debt, 25% equity capital structure, and they have offered to lock in a 5% cost of debt and a 12% return on equity in today's market.
Question, Senator Dinwiddie.
To the Chair, could you please repeat those numbers?
Sure. 75% debt and 25% equity, and a 12% return on equity and a 5% cost of debt. In the pipeline world, those are pretty good numbers. And I want to show you on the next slide here what the state could hope to benefit by trying to improve on those fairly good commercial terms. And compare it to what might be at stake if the project got delayed. Okay, so there's three sets of numbers shown here on three different panels. The panel on the very left looks at the debt equity mix. So what is the capital structure of the project? The middle data point there is the offer from TransCanada, the 75% debt and 25% equity. And we just moved that capital structure by 5% either direction, saying what if there's a little bit more debt, what if there's a little bit more equity. Now, one thing to keep in mind is, as you increase the amount of equity in the capital structure, because equity tends to be more expensive, it's the 12% compared to the 5% for the debt, it increases your weighted interest cost, essentially. And so the direction you want to move if you want to improve your capital structure is to have more debt in the mix and less equity, because it lowers your overall interest cost of that amount. And so what this shows here is that for a 5% change in that capital structure, that is equivalent to about $200 million in additional NPV to the state. Okay? Now let's hold that number and move to the second panel, which is looking at the return on equity. Again, TransCanada's offer is the 12% return on equity, which is the rightmost number of the three ROEs that we're looking at here. And if we try to improve this by bringing in a third party and having them bid on this, and let's say we get 11% ROE, or we get a 10% return on equity requirement, the impact of each percentage decrease in the return on equity that a company will want results in about $100 million in additional NPV to the state. Okay? So if we found a partner that was just as qualified as TransCanada that wanted to give us an 80-20 debt-equity mix and, let's say, a 10% ROE, we have improved the commercial terms on the table that we have from TransCanada. And if you add those together, that's about $300 million, between the ROE improvement and the debt-equity improvement. Let's move to the last panel on the right and look at, but what if that results in a year's delay to the project, and what does that cost the state? What you see here is that a single year's delay in the project ends up costing the state $800 million plus or minus in NPV. And so any improvement in the commercial terms that you could get would likely get washed away by the delay, if there's a delay that accompanies that improvement in commercial terms.
So if I may, are you saying if we didn't use TransCanada, there would be a delay and that would be costly?
Mr. Chairman, I'm saying if we didn't use TransCanada and the process to replace them resulted in a delay for the project, then it comes at a significant cost to the state.
Okay, and then I'm going to go to Senator Dunleavy, but isn't it true that any of the oil companies could build the pipeline? Granted, we don't know if they would do it as cheaply or inexpensive because we didn't do a competitive bid.
Mr. Chairman, yes. They would certainly have the experience and the qualifications needed to build this project by themselves. But like I said, TransCanada has been studying the pipeline route associated with this project, because of AGEA, over since the period that they've had the license. And that knowledge is something that they hold that the producers would now need to replicate or procure. And the state would lose having a third party participate in the project and those different incentives that third party would have.
Senator Dunleavy?
Thank you, to the Chair. Based upon your experience, or expertise, I should say, in your opinion, does the state have in-house expertise to negotiate and construct these projects on their own? And if not, what would the state have to do to actually be able to do that effectively? So does the state currently have the expertise, based upon your experience in this business?
Senator Dunleavy, through the Chair, my short answer would be no. Not to say that the state couldn't get that expertise by hiring the people that would bring that to the state, but as we stand here today, I don't think that's an activity the state has been involved in and has a history with or experience with so far.
So currently they don't have the expertise, and to get that expertise would take time and money? Expense?
Yes.
And do you think that, this is conjecture obviously, but do you think that, is that a route that's worth exploring, or from your experience, does it ever end up paying off, or are you better off going with a partner such as we're describing here with TransCanada? Can you build that expertise? Can you build that the capacity to do the negotiations in a cost-effective and time-effective manner, or generally speaking, does that not happen?
Senator Dunleavy, through the Chair, I would separate out the negotiation experience from, project development and execution experience. I think those are different skill sets, and I'm sure, the state has many, many qualified professionals that have vast negotiation experience that can possibly do this. The project development and execution and the engineering and project management that's going to be needed for this project is a bigger challenge. And my observation on that would be, if the state wanted to go down the path of trying to bring that expertise in-house, this is not the project you want to cut your teeth on. You know, you'd be picking one of the most complex projects in the world to try to go up that learning curve, and I don't know that that would be a great idea.
Thanks.
Proceed, please.
So moving to the fourth question, fourth and last question, I'm asking, well, does TransCanada bear any financial risk in all of this? You know, we've talked about the state's various risks in this project. So just looking at it from a slightly different perspective and saying, TransCanada is committed to being involved in the Alaska LNG project and committed to certain commercial terms as part of the Memorandum of Understanding. What are some of the risks they face from their perspective? So as we talked about here, the commercial terms that they've committed to with the capital structure as well as the return on equity and cost of debt is meaningful, because given the scale of this project and all of the uncertainties associated with it and how early we are in this project's development, the financing is still far away in the horizon. And so locking in that capital structure before you know what your actual financing agreements are going to be places a risk on TransCanada that they could not be able to match in the market what they have committed to using on paper as a cost to the state. And that could result in an erosion of their earnings from the project, as well as an under-earning on their return on equity, the 12% that they've asked for. Over the next two slides, let's look and see how that could play out. What we're showing here are essentially the effective ROE, or the effective return on equity that TransCanada would earn if their actual capital structure and financing arrangements differed from what they have committed to in the agreement with the state. And so the blue line, and at the very left of it, is what they have committed to with the state. And that's the point where they earning a 12% return on equity. It's a 75% debt mix, 25% equity mix, and a 5% cost of debt. Okay? Now, instead of 5%, if their cost of debt changes to 6%, what happens is you jump down to the green line, and assuming they can still finance 75% of this in the markets, the impact on their ROE is a drop of 2% right away. And so rather than earning 12% return on equity, they're only going to be earning 10% return on their equity. If we stretch that further and say, what if their cost of debt goes up by 2% and they're at 7% instead of 5%, now they're only earning about 8.5% return on their equity rather than the 12% that they would be expecting to. And you see a similar erosion in their ROE as you go down each of those lines as well, which is saying that the market doesn't allow them to borrow 75% of what they need for this project. We saw earlier this morning about how the market could limit, you know, the percentage of debt that the state can borrow. If TransCanada has similar constraints at the time that it is in the financial market trying to borrow for this project, and they're only able to borrow 70% of the project as debt, or they're only able to borrow 65% of the project as debt, they start sliding down each of those lines in terms of their effective ROE. And so there is some risk to TransCanada of locking in, you know, the financial terms with the state this early in the process before they've reached the point where the financing has actually been done. I want to distinguish one nuance here, which is that the risks that TransCanada faces is that its financial strength will erode from where they are today. Okay? And I'm making that point because technically what they have in the MOU is 12% ROE plus what they're calling a rate tracker, which takes away the risk of the general market cost of debt changing. Okay, we all recognize that at this point in time today, debt is cheap from a historic perspective. And so there's, you know, it's not an unreasonable expectation that the cost of debt and the interest rates will go up through time from here. When that turnaround happens, we don't know, but that's likely the direction it could go. So the deal that TransCanada has with the state will not expose TransCanada to that risk, sort of the structural market risk of interest rates generally rising. But what it does expose TransCanada to is its own financial balance sheet not being as strong when it needs to finance this project as it is today. So one way to think about it is they probably stand at this point in time and say, I can get debt for this project at a 5% cost. But come 2019, when you're at FID and ready to start putting real money into this project, if the financial market doesn't look at them that same way, and they say, well, given how much you're borrowing for this project, it's in the billions of dollars, you're not going to be able to get all of that at 5%. I mean, we saw this morning, even for the state with its AAA rating, you know, those interest rates we were looking at were above 5.6% once the borrowing amount started increasing. And so to the extent that TransCanada has, you know, that similar risk, then the analysis that we're showing here captures the effective ROE changing on them and the risk that they have of underrunning relative to their expectations. On slide 20, we translate what that return on equity means in terms of actual net present value to TransCanada from the project. And first of all, it's always sort of interesting to me that given the scale of this project and the amount of money involved, that TransCanada's net present value, you know, is in the order of a couple of $100 million. But taking that as it is, what this shows again is a similar framework to the one we saw on the previous slide, except instead of looking at their effective return on equity, we're looking at their actual NPVs or expected NPVs from the project. And again, if they move from a 5% cost of debt to a 6% cost of debt, they've eroded most of their NPV. You know, they're below $50 million in NPV. And in fact, they have a risk of going negative from a net present value perspective if their actual cost of debt should be as high as 7%. And similarly, when we move across each of these lines, you see their net present value decreasing as what it costs them to finance the project exceeds what they have they will be able to recover from the state under the negotiation. So pulling that all together, and sort of revisiting the questions as well as the answers from our discussion here today, is there an economic impact to the state from having TransCanada? And the answer is yes. You know, we saw that more investment means more earnings, and because the state will be investing less with TransCanada in the mix, we will also be earning less. And the, you know, in terms of the dollar amount, on a total cash flow basis, we saw that the state's total cash flows were reduced by about $4 billion. From an NPV perspective, recognizing that making upfront capital cost investment is expensive for the state, the impact was marginal. And then, can the state go it alone? From a capital investment perspective, having TransCanada in the picture can reduce the state's investment by $4 to $7 billion, and that is a meaningful amount in the initial years before there are any revenues for the state to be able to support that that investment. And the other thing we saw this morning is that the state does not have limitless borrowing capacity. If the state tries to adhere to prudent debt policy and only want to assign, you know, a certain portion of the general fund unrestricted revenue towards servicing the Alaska LNG project, then that places some constraints on how much the state can borrow if the state tries to go it alone. Is TransCanada a good partner? Indications are yes, it is. It has experience, and it has experience here in Alaska, demonstrating interest in the project and studying this particular project. It comes in as a third party with incentive to expand the project, which is one of the state's objectives. And given its involvement to date, it helps to keep the momentum going on the project at the pace that we're currently seeing. And, we looked at the question of is TransCanada bearing financial risk in this, or is this a riskless deal for them? And we saw that committing to these financing arrangements with the state this early in the project does expose them to risks, both from eroding the actual return on equity that they can earn on the project, but also in lowering their NPV, which under a good case here is at $200 million. And so putting all of those facts together, I think it starts painting a picture where you can start drawing conclusions that there are some fairly good reasons here why it makes sense to have TransCanada be in the project the way it is currently envisioned to be, and it sheds some light on the rationale, I think, getting to this point, and the decision that's in front of this committee as well as the legislature this session.
Very good. Senator Fairclough has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the concept of the state doing it alone and investing over time and not seeing a return on that investment for a period of years, if we were a corporation and we were making that same investment, or a producer, one of our other proposed partners in this process, would they not take that rate of return or lost opportunity cost out later in the process and return that money to shareholders in the calculations that they put? And would that affect the tariff rates or other components of the project?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, would any other party expect to earn a return on its investment in the project? If I'm understanding your question right, yes, anybody would. And even if this were an integrated project, from the producer's perspective, the entire project has to earn a certain return. And the concept of this project development, supported by future earnings, is that each of these companies has an expectation that the upfront cash flows that they're committing to the project are going to earn, healthy returns for them in the future.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions? Seeing none at this time. Thank you very much for your presentation. And again, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having me.
Okay, I think we're going to change out presenters. Is it Mr. Mayor or Meyer? Yeah, you're Mayor, I'm Meyer. Okay. Just make sure I understand who's who here.
One of us is one of them.
Yeah, okay. And how do you pronounce your last name?
Sophos.
Okay.
Thank you.
Whenever you guys are ready. It seems strange not to be talking oil taxes with you, Mr. Mayor.
Dave.
Similar subject, but yet so much different.
Yes.
All right. Are you guys set? You ready? It's you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, the others will come. They're just taking a break.
For the record, I'm Janik Mayer, a partner in Analytica. This is now my third year sitting at this Senate Finance table, talking about oil and gas issues, advising the legislature. The pre- previous 2 years, of course, as you say, Mr. Chair, on oil tax issues, now around advising on gas commercialization issues that the state faces, looking at the LNG project to commercialize North Slope gas. For the last 6 or more years, I've been with the consultancy PFC Energy, and of course my previous work around this table was with PFC, eventually leading the analytics team there, the team that does all of the sort of modeling of upstream economics and financial models to understand the impacts of things like fiscal terms on returns to investments in upstream assets. I've modeled fields, portfolios, companies for any range of purposes, from national oil companies to large international oil companies to small private equity firms, to value transactions, to understand the nature of different deals, and to understand questions of fiscal reform. That's my background. Today we'll be giving a high-level overview presentation on some of the issues that the committee faces with the proposed project. And to kick that off, I'll hand over to my colleague, Nikos Safos.
Thank you.
Thank you, Janik. For the record, my name is Nikos Safos, also partner at Analytica. Similar to Janik, my background comes from last 7.5 years. I worked for a company called PFC Energy. One of my last roles there was heading the firm's global gas practice on the consulting side. And in that capacity, I've worked with oil and gas companies and governments and financial institutions around the world on a number of issues, but chiefly my consulting experience has revolved around three ideas: helping companies that have gas sell it, helping companies that want to buy gas buy it, and then helping companies understand how markets are changing around the world. And so that is the lens through which I look at the Alaska LNG project. Knowing that this is a Friday afternoon, and I suspect we'll be seeing more of you over the coming days and weeks, we wanted to provide a high-level overview of the questions that we think the legislature has to grapple with this session in terms of natural gas and LNG. And we wanted, in particular, to kick it off with three big ideas that will form the foundation for the work that we'll be presenting over time to you. Thank you. The three big ideas are competitiveness, project pathway alignment. Competitiveness, we want to talk a little bit about where Alaska sits in the world and how you should think about that. Project pathway, we want to talk a little bit about where we are in the process and what you might expect, not just over the next 2 months, but realistically over the next 6 years. And also want to talk about alignment and try to give you a sense of how do we understand alignment and what's really driving the broadest question, I think, in front of you, which is this question of taking equity and possibly switching from an in-value world to an in-kind world. So those are the three themes that we want to talk about. I will cover competitiveness and project pathways, and my colleague Janik is going to look into alignment. Okay? So let's begin with competitiveness. And the point of departure for this slide is to talk about a number of different ideas. This is a map that we showed in this room a few weeks ago, and the message of this map is well known to you, which is that you're not alone in the world, and I think this is fairly well understood. You're not alone in the world. There are lots of other places that are looking to supply the world of natural gas and LNG in particular, some of them close by, like Western Canada, the lower 48, and some of them really, really far away. We don't necessarily want to talk about each of these places, but we wanted to talk a little bit about a couple of ideas in particular. One is that when you look at this world, it's tempting sometimes to look at yourself and identify all the obstacles that you face, and then look at others and say and think how great they're doing. Because there's always a tendency the further away you go, things look better than what they are up close. So the first thing we wanted to point out is that every single one of these places may look really tempting from afar, but as you get closer, each of these competing suppliers have a number of challenges that they'll have to overcome before they can get to the market. And the reason this is important is one of the things that you've seen the administration present, our consultants present, and we'll talk about is this is without a doubt a fairly expensive project. Not just because it's $45 to $65 billion, but on a unit cost, it's a very expensive project. And there's a general concern about, well, is this project even real? Can you really even hope to have a project that is so expensive, especially when there are all these other supply options around the world? And the answer to that is a sort of qualified yes, and this is what I really wanted to get across in the question of competitiveness. And to reassure you somewhat that just because a project is expensive doesn't mean a project doesn't get built. So as a thought process and as a thought experiment, we went back and we recreated this map. This is slide 5 now, of what it looked like in the mid to late 2000s. The date is a little bit murky. And we wanted to ask the question of, well, what did the world look like then? And if you were sitting in my job in 2006 or 7 or 8 when I was doing this for PFC Energy and you were trying to figure out where the LNG supply is going to come from, this is the world that you would look at. There are a few other things on the map. We didn't try to be exhaustive in terms of every single proposal that was out there. But the point is that at that time, actually, the world looked pretty good. A lot of options out there. If you were a buyer of gas, you could feel very comfortable. Venezuela was going out there with three trains that they wanted to build. Trinidad had just finished off its fourth train, was working on a fifth. Egypt had started LNG in 2004 and 5, was looking at expansions. Libya had just opened up after the deal with Gaddafi, brought in oil companies. Shell, BP, Eni all had proposed LNG plants there. Algeria was very ambitious. Snøhvit in Norway had just started up, and Statoil, the sponsor, was looking to expand that project. Shtokman, this field in Russia that has been sitting there for decades, finally had a partnership structure, and things seemed to be moving ahead. Nigeria at the time was looking to become one of the largest LNG countries in the world. I remember actually one of my first research reports at PFC Energy was talking about Nigeria's LNG build-out, and at that time we were struggling about whether we should be pessimistic and talk about, well, maybe these won't come online until 2010 or 11 or 12. Myanmar, Australia, Qatar, and Iran. The bottom line is that most of these things didn't happen. Venezuela got nowhere. Trinidad 5 got canceled. Snøhvit expansion didn't happen. Shtokman didn't happen. The projects in North Africa, most of them didn't happen. West Africa, definitely Nigeria, and the additions in Equatorial Guinea haven't happened yet. And all the action happened in Australia. And the reason that this is key is because there's many things you can say about Australia, but the one thing you cannot say about Australia, it was not the low-cost supplier. Australia was many things. It was not the cheapest place to get LNG. And so the lesson here for a supplier that is admittedly on the expensive side of the curve is don't despair. Just because you're expensive doesn't mean that there's no world for you. At the end of the day, what really matters is can you find a price that makes you happy and a buyer happy? That's all that matters at the end of the day. And so the question of competitiveness is important, but there's more to having a successful project than just having the cheapest source of supply out there. Because there are some times that the supply is cheap and there's a reason for it. It's because it just can't happen. And this is what even very recent experience has shown us. Let's move on to theme number 2 and talk about project pathways. Before we talk about Alaska, I'd like to talk about Australia. And I want to talk about this one project, Queensland Curtis, that's what QC means, LNG. And we picked this project for no particular reason except that it made for a good story and we thought a representative story. So don't read too much into why is it Queensland Curtis and not some other project. We just thought it would be easier to highlight the points that we wanted to make through one project rather than through 10. And what we wanted to show you is to make the point that projects evolve. There's a great deal of anxiety and concern, we think, as we've talked to people, and a rightful concern, about how much does the state of Alaska lock itself into a particular pathway. What are the decisions that you will make here today that are going to predispose future legislatures or future generations of Alaskans into a specific path? And so in helping to answer this question, we wanted to say, well, how do LNG projects work in general? And this is an example. So what we've done here is we've taken three snapshots of this project. We've taken one snapshot in July 2008, one snapshot in October 2010, and one snapshot, which is in January 2014. The first snapshot, it's at the FEED, the front end engineering and design stage, which is where you would like to be in a year and a half to 2 years. So you, Alaska LNG, is not even on this chart. You are left of this chart. Okay? You haven't even gotten to the first column. The second column is FID, final investment decision. This is when all the partners get together and they say, let's do it. And that's when you start spending the real money. And January 2014 is just the present. And by the way, this project is not yet online. So this is a picture of a project that has yet to ship its first cargo. Let's see what happened to this project. The size actually changed. At the FEED, the partners were thinking about one train, maybe 3 or 4 million tons, but they had a hope of maybe getting to 12 at some point. By the time they got to FID, this was a two-train project with 8.5 million tons. The upstream to feed this project was a combination of BG Group, that's a UK company, and QGC, this is Queensland Gas Company, which BG had bought into. So the gas was coming from BG and essentially their partner that they had bought into. The liquefaction ownership was 70% BG, 30% Queensland Curtis. And all the gas, this idea of a long-term contract that we talk about, at that time, all the gas was going to be taken by BG. This is what the project looked like in July 2008. By the time it got to FID, you can see that new partners had come in on the upstream, CNOOC, one of the three major Chinese oil companies. Tokyo Gas, the utility of Tokyo, had taken some shares in parts of the Surat Basin. This is in Queensland. The liquefaction facility had changed. The first train was 90% owned by BG and 10% owned by CNOOC. The second train was 97.5% owned by BG and 2.5% owned by Tokyo Gas. The offtake, CNOOC had agreed to take 3.6 million tons. Tokyo Gas had agreed to take 1.2 million tons. And the rest was going to go to BG. So this is what the world looked like when BG, CNOOC, Tokyo Gas went to their boards and say, can you please give us some money? Can we please give the green light to this project? This is what the project looked like. This is what it looks like today in January 2014 or February 2014. They're actually getting some gas from a competing LNG project because they need to supplement their own gas. CNOOC has taken a larger share in some of the upstream. The ownership structure has changed. CNOOC has increased its share of train one, and CNOOC has acquired an option for train three if there is an expansion. Train three is not under construction, it's an option. And CNOOC, by the way, in that deal also reimbursed BG for some of the costs up until that time. The offtake changed. CNOOC increased its share of the gas, and Chubu Electric came in. And in fact, if you do the math, you see that now the project has sold more than 8.5 million tons of LNG, even though it's an 8.5 million ton project. The idea being that BG is going to be supplying this gas not just from this project, but from other projects. And then the project also secured financing, official sector financing from JBIC. This is the Japan International Bank, the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, and also from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which financed this project. The point here is you are left of this slide. You haven't even gone on the slide. And this is a fairly typical evolution for LNG projects. And the reason we think this is important is because there's some questions today in this session in front of you that have to do with equity shares and financing and participation and offtake. And it may seem that you're making long-term commitments, and you are, but those long-term commitments aren't as rigid or aren't as bolted down today as they may seem. LNG projects change, and LNG projects change quite dramatically, even in this case, from the time of the FEED process until before the project has come online. So let's take this picture a little bit and go to think about what it means for Alaska LNG. So let's skip to slide 7 now. We've tried to give a sense here of where we are in the process. This is fairly similar to a slide you've seen from both the administration as well as their consultants. And really, we are now at the process of trying to get to pre-FEED, where you're sort of doing a scoping exercise, trying to make sense of whether you have a project. And the milestone of that is to try to move to FEED once you've done the pre-FEED. At the marketing level, you basically are probably maybe reaching out to some folks, trying to figure out if buyers are interested in your gas. You may sign a memorandum of understanding for the sale of gas. You may sign a heads of agreement for the sale of gas. And you're mostly going to be trying to think about what the state of Alaska marketing plan is. Do you market this by yourself? Do you invite others? Who do you invite? That's the kind of progress that you'll probably be looking to make over the next couple of years. On the financing thing, you'll be talking about, you know, the capacity of the state, you know, what can the state really take on as debt, who might be interested to lend money to the state, what possible official sector sources of finance may be available, JBIC, equivalent in Korea, Japan. You'll be defining the ownership structure, and there's an investment at this stage that, and these numbers are coming from the plan that you have before you that's attached to the HOA, you know, about $400 or $500 million, and there's a share of, to the state of Alaska. Then you go to the FEED process, and then you start sort of zeroing in on some of these things with the goal of getting the final investment decision maybe somewhere around 2018. At that time, you actually start talking about finalizing some of these deals. Who do we sell the gas to? For what volume? For what price? What term? Financing, who's actually going to give us money? Not just talk anymore, but start talking about signing loans. At that point, and even further, you're probably going to be looking for potential new partners and maybe changing the ownership structure. As we showed before, in the case of Queensland Curtis, one of the buyers, CNOOC, said, I want to buy some gas, but I also want to buy a share of the project. I want to be an owner myself. So you'll be having those kind of discussions. And the project investment obviously ramps up. But even at that time, at the construction level, you still have only spent a very small fraction of the total investment. You can still talk about marketing at that level if you have any unsold LNG. You can still talk about financing, as you saw from the previous slide. Queensland Curtis LNG secured JBIC and USX Exim Bank financing after they started construction. They brought in new partners, or they redefined the ownership, even at that late stage. And obviously at that point, the capital outlays become more significant. And then you bring online, and even actually at that point, you can bring in new partners. Now obviously, we understand that the rationale for bringing new partners may be mostly related to limiting the exposure on the investment side. So maybe after it's online, you don't have to worry about it as much. But again, it's not atypical for companies to come in and buy an equity share even in an existing project if at some point you wanted to quote-unquote liquidate that asset and cash in on that asset. Bottom line is lots of stuff changes between now and the FEED process, the pre-FEED process, the FEED process, and even construction. And so when you think about the options in front of you, and we've put a big green box with the arrow because that's what we want to talk about today, but rest assured that we'll come back to the bottom of this table. And so in effect, and this is a slightly simplifying chart, what are the basically four pathways that you have? The status quo has the state taking gas in value and no ownership anywhere. So you have no ownership percent. These are the first three zeros, which therefore mean that you don't have to pay any of the capex, with the exception of any tax impacts of additional investment. If you're not an equity owner, you don't have any debt to pay. And the tariff really only matters for valuation purposes. You want to come up with a tariff so that then you can estimate what the value is at the wellhead, which you will tax as royalty and as production tax. What the HOA does, it changes the first column from in value to in kind, potentially. Again, not a given, but that is sort of a possibility that is envisioned by the HOA. And that's why I say if you wanted to be clever, you could turn this table into having, you know, more like 15 options. So we're trying to limit that for sake of clarity. The option still remains 0% from an ownership stake, but the GDP pipeline and LNG, now the state gets 25%, which then on the next three columns means that you're on the hook for a share of that capital expenditure. And it means your cash commitments are going to be principal and interest for any debt that you take. And the tariff only matters notionally, because you own 25% of the pipe, you have 25% of the gas, you have 25% of the liquefaction facility, and you can argue about how to pay yourself a tariff, but it doesn't really matter. It matters for purposes of valuation, possibly for the royalty, but you're arguing with yourselves, you're not arguing with anyone else, because you have 25%, you use the 25%, the producers use 75%. And the bottom two options are about the MOU and how that changes, and we'll talk about that probably next time we're in front of you, and try to quantify all these different options. But we wanted, and I'll hand it over to Janik now, to motivate a little bit that top part. Why might you go from what the status quo is to the HOA world, and in particular, how should you be thinking about this idea of in value versus in kind?
Thank you. For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. Our third and final big picture theme for the evening is about alignment. Now, already after just a few weeks of session, I feel like I tremble every time I say alignment, because it's been said so many times in the weeks leading up to now, and by the time the end of session comes, I'm sure it's a word we will all be well and truly sick of hearing. But we say it so many times, the administration said it so many times, their consultants have said it so many times, because it really is crucial to moving any massive project like this forward, and crucial in particular to some of the issues that Alaska in particular faces when considering this. And there are many ways of thinking about alignment. We wanted to very graphically illustrate to you what we mean in particular when we talk about alignment, and why this question of how the state derives value from being the ultimate sovereign resource holder of the gas in the North Slope, and how that question of alignment actually works out through the math of thinking about, for instance, the way the current tax calculation works, as an illustration as to why the state might want to think about other ways of being better aligned with the producers and the way that the producers generate value. And so the way we wanted to do this was in particular because a lot of legislators, for instance, have a lot of experience with oil and the debate around oil taxes, but less familiarity with gas. The way gas is different on numerous fronts, but even just the units that we use to think about gas. And so to start off by bringing that world of gas back to the world of oil and comparing it and showing some of the crucial ways it's different and why that question of alignment can be quite critical when we think about gas and how the state generates value from the from its gas in the North Slope. So just to flashback to previous years in that sense and discussion around oil taxes. Here we have on the slide, very, very familiar by now, reproduction essentially of what the Department of Revenue shows in the Revenue Sources book. This is the 2015 numbers for calculation of the production tax under the SB21 structure, where we, of course, as I say, very familiar, start with a gross value that is netted back to the wellhead by subtracting away midstream costs. So we start, for instance, with oil at in this case the 2015 Department of Revenue forecast of $105 a barrel. But that's $105 a barrel at the West Coast. At the wellhead on the North Slope, it's about $10 a barrel less than that, because we have $6 in particular to pay for the TAPS tariff, as well as about $3.50 for marine transportation and some additional costs around quality banking and other things like that. And so we then have a $95 barrel of oil. We, of course, subtract out, in this case, based on the increasingly higher levels of expenditures we see on the North Slope, around $46 a barrel in lease expenditures, calculate production tax based on that netback, and the rest of the calculation follows. We haven't included the question of credits, et cetera, here, because we're not trying to look at what does Alaska get in particular in revenue in any given year under SB 21. The comparison is simply meant to be the comparison with gas and how that changes, which we'll see on coming pages. So in particular, if we think about that world of how the state at the moment gets value for its oil from taxes, and think about how does this change in the world of gas? Well, the first thing to say is that gas is a much, much, much less transparent business than oil. Sure, oil prices can vary based on the quality of the crude involved, but overall it's a very liquid world market. I can open up the newspaper and see what Brent is trading at, what WTI is trading at, possibly what ANS West Coast is trading at, and have a pretty good idea based on production figures of what revenues based on wellhead value will be. Gas, I have absolutely no idea. I can't pick up the newspaper and find out what the gas price is. There is no gas price. There could be, and we showed at this table with a presentation we did for the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in late January, in fact, just how widely gas prices can vary. Not only do they vary massively between different regions, they vary within regions, they even vary within countries. One of the slides we showed at that presentation was of landed gas price into Korea over the last 12 months or so, the previous year, where the cheapest price of LNG into Korea was almost half the most expensive price of LNG into Korea. The price of LNG is dependent entirely on the specific contract that a specific cargo is sold under. Some of it is sold under very long-term contracts signed at a time when the market was scarce. Some was sold at a time when supply was plentiful. Some is sold under spot prices. And so prices of any cargo of LNG can vary dramatically by 50% or more, depending on all of those factors. So I can't just look at the newspaper and say, well, I know what the price of gas is and therefore what revenue I'm getting. All of that is much less transparent and much more subject to things that are governed by confidentiality clauses and things that are much harder, black boxes that are much more impenetrable to look into. By and large, most LNG contracts, and one might expect this for Alaska, are linked, in particular when it comes to sales into Asia, to crude oil, to what we refer to as JCC, colloquially Japan Crude Cocktail, officially the Japan Customs Cleared price of oil. But a linkage to oil doesn't mean it's necessarily priced the same as oil. By and large, it's priced at a discount. These contracts have a pricing formula that says the price of gas will have this relationship to oil, usually expressed as a coefficient of a regression line, essentially, where a particular slope, for instance, 0.16 of crude oil equates to exact parity, thermal parity, where the same heat value of gas costs the same amount as the heat content of a barrel of oil. But frequently, LNG contracts don't have that slope at parity. They have it at something less, 0.15, 0.14, 0.13. So, for instance, if we were to look at a $100 oil world and say we're selling LNG into Japan on a 0.13 slope contract, well, we'd actually be getting $81 per barrel of oil equivalent in terms of the heat content of our LNG, not the $100 of the crude oil price, even though we were selling under a crude oil-linked contract. So there's lower value in terms of thermal efficiency, thermal equivalency. More than any of those things, though, the biggest difference are that the midstream looks almost unrecognizable compared to the midstream for oil. When we looked at the midstream for oil, we saw here, you know, $6.18 tariff for the TAPS pipeline. The sorts of tariffs we're going to be talking about for an LNG project, for the combination of gas treatment and processing, pipeline, and liquefaction, are going to be an order of magnitude higher than anything we're used to from the world of oil. Not only that, but by and large, these are not going to be tariffs that are regulated by FERC for rate-setting purposes, even if the projects are regulated by FERC for permitting and environmental purposes. So, and we also then have the fact that, and the administration and their consultants have, I think, pointed this out to you already, whatever tariff one does apply to this infrastructure is very, very highly sensitive to a range of assumptions that are used in setting that tariff. What's the capital structure? What's the initial cost of capital? How each of these variables plays out can have a massive impact on what the tariff you pay is. And so there's enormous scope for dispute about what's the correct method for setting the tariff on this piece of infrastructure, what is the actual correct value to attribute to that, and as a result of that, when we net back to the wellhead, what's the actual value of the gas on the North Slope as opposed to the gas when it's delivered into Asia. So bearing all those things in mind, let's take this working of the tax calculation for gas and think about for oil and think about it instead for gas. As we said, discount to oil in terms of thermal equivalency. So if we think about this gas in barrels of oil equivalent, instead of that, for instance, $100 oil price, we might instead at that $100 ANS West Coast be getting $81 per barrel of oil equivalent for our LNG. So a substantial discount. But the big eye-opener here is we look at the midstream and look at the sorts of tariffs that have been talked about at this table already in dollar per million BTU terms, you know, $2 per million BTUs or so, $2.20 maybe for a pipeline, $1.80 for the gas processing, $4 something for liquefaction, etc. But instead of talking about those in dollar per MMBTU terms, talk about them in dollar per barrel of oil equivalent terms. And you suddenly start to realize what we're talking about is all up somewhere around or north of a $66 a barrel tariff for the entire midstream component. Right? It's a huge, huge portion of the total value. And what that huge portion of the total value means is that even at the sorts of oil prices we have at the moment, when you net back to the wellhead, already with this $66 a barrel tariff, in a $100 oil world, which means $81 a barrel in LNG terms, we take out that $66 tariff, well, we've got not very much left in terms of value either for our royalty or to tax. Even if we assume very minimal lease expenditures, we assume basically $3 per barrel of oil equivalent in operating and $3 in per dollar barrel of oil equivalent for capital expenditures. We take off just $6, for instance, for lease expenditures, and on a production tax basis, we have only $8 out of that barrel, that $100 oil or $81 oil equivalent LNG, to tax. And so in that sense, a whole debate around what should that tax rate be, for instance, when whether it's 10%, 20%, 30%, 40% of a very small number is still a very small number. Because all the actual value has gone in the midstream, and the pure upstream value is very, very low. Not only that, but because the upstream value is very low, and because so much of the value is in the midstream, and this basic idea, the basic way in which the state at the moment gets its value, both from its royalty, because the royalty, of course, is based on the value at the wellhead, so we net back all of the costs involved in transportation, even forgetting the question of then further netting away the costs of production for production tax. Because those fixed components that we take away to get back to the wellhead are so large, just small changes, either in a range of variables, but particularly, for instance, in either the cost of that midstream or in the price can completely take away the state's value altogether. So for instance, if instead of $100 per barrel ANS West Coast price, we went down to $89 a barrel ANS West Coast price, we suddenly have no production tax value whatsoever, and we'd have only very marginal gross value even for our royalty. Similarly, if we remained in that $100 ANS but $81 thermal equivalency for gas basis, but instead increased the overall project costs so that tariffs rose by 12.2%, that similarly would wipe out any production tax value and leave only a sliver of value in terms of value of the royalty at the wellhead. So what this means is, unlike the world of oil, you know, we spent an enormous part of the last many years and decades looking at things like the TAPS tariff and the state and others, thinking, you know, is this tariff too high? Are we really getting the value we should be at the wellhead? And the interests of the state versus the interests of the producers being very different and on different sides of the table. And if you think about that and all the issues that that has caused, and think about what those will be with a $66-plus tariff on the midstream, that, it seems to us, brings this picture of alignment and why alignment is absolutely critical right into focus. So in conclusion, the fundamental differences are ensuring a fair market price for the gas that you receive is critical in the gas world in a way that it's just taken for granted in the oil world. More than anything though, midstream. That's where the overwhelming majority of the costs in this project are going to be, and because that's where the majority of the costs are going to be one way or another, that's where a huge portion of the value is going to accrue. And so if the state remains simply a wellhead taxing, wellhead royalty generating entity, it's cutting itself off from a huge amount of the value in this project and leaving itself exposed to the ability for the rest of that midstream to take up actually almost all the value, leaving it with very little. That's because the upstream is secondary to the midstream in that sense, in the project size and the project value, leaving the wellhead value insufficient to drive state take. That concludes our presentation for today. As I say, we wanted to keep it high-level, broad, touch on the big themes the legislature needs to consider when thinking about this question of understanding what's been put before it on the table, what's been bolted down, what hasn't, what the pathway from here forward will look like, and then in particular understanding, if we come back to this question of status quo versus in particular the world of the heads of agreement, and why it is that perhaps the administration, in what they have negotiated so far, is looking at this question of participating through equity in a project, of taking gas not as a value at the wellhead in terms of royalty or production tax on production tax value at the wellhead, but instead of as a gas share of gas that gets transported through the state's infrastructure and sold into Asia. Why that might be and why this question of alignment might be critical. We will come back to all of these themes in a great deal more detail over the coming weeks with modelling and more quantitative analysis, but we wanted to frame the issues with this tonight.
Great. Well, I appreciate it, Janik and Nikos, and I appreciate you keeping it at a high level for tonight. It's obviously very complicated, at least to me. I know Senator Bishop, Senator Fairclough have seen this presentation before, and so we'll have a lot more detail as we go through the process. But I think for tonight, this has been very enlightening for a Friday evening. So, is there any questions for our consultants before we adjourn? No, thank you very much. And we are going to reconvene on Monday morning, 8 o'clock. And we're going to try to hear a few bills. Well, sorry, first 8 o'clock, we'll finish up two small departments on the capital budget. and then we'll hear some bills that hopefully we can maybe pass out that aren't too controversial, and then we come back Monday night to take up some more presentations from, it looks like Joe Balash and Mr. Pulaski. Yes, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to put on the record that Senator Bishop and I are on the Resource Committee, and our chairman has scheduled a meeting at 8 o'clock. So we'll need to be at her meeting to establish a quorum, and okay. We'll either watch the capital presentation later or listen to it.
You're going to watch it from Resources?
No, later.
Yeah, that should be okay. We're just going to finish up the two department overviews. Again, pretty small departments. I guess DEC has quite a bit of capital. But we should still have, I think, Senator Olson, will you be here Monday? Okay, yeah, we should be fine then. Okay, very good. Well, thank you. And with that, everybody have a good weekend. See you Monday morning.